arranged by geographical location and tribal affiliation. Eastern, Plains, Lake, Northwestern, Southwestern, and Pueblo Indians. The chapter for each of the 18 tribes began with a historical overview and summary of the tribe's religious beliefs, symbols, language, food, family, and village customs. Natalie also included contextual narratives about landscape and environment, and vignettes of her experiences among the American Indians. The book's transcriptions of Indian songs and musical scores were rendered in Natalie's own hand and included her notes about tempo and nuance. The words of the songs were written both in their native tongue and in English translation. With the help of one of her editors, Kurt Schindler, Natalie designed a transcription system that arranged musical phrases like lines of verse and made the song flash before the eye, like the form of a stanza in poetry. There was no previous publication on Indian music or folklore to which the Indians' book could be compared. The Indians were the authors of the book, Natalie stated in the introduction, and every singer, poet, dancer, medicine man, and storyteller was acknowledged by name and tribe. Natalie was simply the recorder, her task to collect, edit, and arrange the Indians' contributions. With the release of the Indians' book, Natalie's life was dominated by public appearances and speaking engagements. The book was praised by her colleagues in the upper echelon of the professional music world, including Walter Damrosch, the conductor with whom she had been smitten as a teenager. It was a heady time in Natalie's life, an intoxicating year of personal and professional adulation and affirmation. Almost a decade had passed since her physical and psychological collapse and subsequent withdrawal from the professional stage. Finally, her peers understood exactly what the gifted Miss Curtis had been doing out west all these years. By the new year of 1908, Natalie's head and heart longed for the uncluttered spaces and open skies of Indian country, and she announced her plans to return to the west. George was ready to leave New York, too, and together they packed their trunks with desert khakis and riding boots, said farewells to the family at Washington Place, and journeyed by train into the land of the sun. Natalie and George arrived in Escondido, California, on January 6th, and moved into rented rooms in the town of Riverside. George wanted to find work on a local ranch or fruit farm, and the next morning, after meeting a Mr. Bailey, he left Natalie in Riverside and took a four-hour ride on the mule-drawn cart of the local mail carrier to a ranch owned by Bailey's friends, the Mendenhalls. Natalie had come to Riverside specifically to talk with Tawakwaptiwa, Chief Lololomai's nephew, whom she met at Oribe several years before. Known around Riverside by his white name, Wilson Fredericks, Tawakwaptiwa was living at the Sherman Institute with his wife and children. Natalie wanted to give Tawakwaptiwa a copy of the Indians book, in which he was a named and much-honored contributor. She also wanted to find out how her Hopi friend and his family were surviving forced relocation at the government Indian school in Riverside. Tawakwaptiwa and 40 of his fellow villagers from Third Mesa had been exiled from Hopi land in 1906 by Roosevelt's Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Francis Loop. The event that precipitated this exile was among the most significant altercations in Hopi history. Following Chief Lololomai's death in 1906, Tawakwaptiwa had become chief and leader of Third Mesa, the largest and most powerful of the Hopi communities. Tawakwaptiwa, like his uncle Chief Lololomai, was a friendly and believed that compromise with Washington could be maintained without the Hopi people losing their cultural integrity. And like his uncle, Tawakwaptiwa hoped to avoid confrontation between the friendlies and the hostiles on Third Mesa, since he believed a split would bring the disintegration of historic Oribe. In the autumn of 1906, shortly after Lololomai's death, the decades-old conflict between the friendlies and the hostiles erupted into confrontation when the hostiles declared that coexistence with the friendlies was no longer possible on Third Mesa. The hostiles, led by Yokiyama, wanted only one faction to live at Oribe. The Hopi, true to their people of peace reputation, commenced the settlement of their conflict not with violence and weapons, although members of both groups were carrying knives, clubs, and even bows and arrows, but with an athletic contest. Late in the day on September 8th, the friendlies and the hostiles gathered on a level stretch of hard ground northwest of the village of Oribe. A line was drawn in the sand from east to west. Yokiyama took a position on the Oribe side of the line and challenged Tawakwaktiwa's men to force him back over the line and away from the village. If the friendlies succeeded, Yokiyama and his followers would leave Oribe. Each faction lined up behind its strongest man. A signal was given, and the great push began. After a long, hard war between the two lines of men, Yokiyama acknowledged defeat. The hostiles packed up their families and belongings, and 298 villagers departed Oribe. Yokiyama moved his people 7 miles to the east, where they settled and built the village of Hotvilla. Although the Hopi had peaceably settled their civil war, Yokiyama was arrested by federal agents and imprisoned at Fort Wingate near Gallup. In the weeks before what historians would call the Oribe split, Tawakwaktiwa, nervous about violence in the village, had sought the counsel of government officials, including Commissioner Loop. Even so, after the hostiles had departed Third Mesa, Loop deemed Tawakwaktiwa a threat to government control of the Hopis and temporarily stripped him of his chieftainship. To avert any additional challenges to federal policies, Loop ordered that Tawakwaktiwa and 40 of his followers be sent to the Sherman Institute for 4 years. Loop then authorized federal troops, augmented by armed Navajo policemen, to seize 82 children from Oribe and take them to the boarding school at Keams Canyon. The reaction by Loop to the Oribe split seemed harsh, heavy-handed, and insensitive to people like Natalie, who hoped the White House was actively reforming federal Indian policies. If Natalie broached the subject or registered a complaint about events at Third Mesa with Roosevelt, it was not recorded. Roosevelt trusted Loop, but also understood that his commissioner, though an exceedingly honest and fearless man, is very prejudiced when he makes up his mind. When Natalie met with Tawakwaktiwa at the Sherman Indian School in January 1908, he and his family had been living in California for 2 years. His hair was short. He spoke nearly fluent English, and he was delighted to see Natalie and to receive a copy of the book in which his songs were recorded. But Tawakwaktiwa was no longer the free-spirited musician of whom Natalie had written. Of all the Hopi poets, none sings a gladder song than Tawakwaktiwa. Sundown shining, a Hopi untouched by foreign influence, the child of natural environment, spontaneous, alert, full of life and laughter. Tawakwaktiwa was now a deeply disillusioned man, acutely antagonized by the white environment he had been thrust into at the Sherman Institute. The betrayal by the U.S. government that he had worked so conscientiously to accommodate had made him bitter and far less tolerant of the non-Indian world. In many ways, Loop's effort to defuse Tawakwaktiwa's power and Hopi tribal identity and independence backfired. In spite of the school's best efforts, the Hopis returned home determined to maintain their Hopi traditions. "I could talk like a gentleman, read, write, and cipher," Oribe native Don C. Taliesa wrote of his education at Sherman. Quote, 100 verses of scripture, debate, shout football yells, swing my partners in square dances, but I wanted to become a real Hopi again, to sing the good old Katsina songs, and to feel free to make love without fear of sin or a rawhide. Natalie was able to remain friends with Tawakwaktiwa, and she would see him again in Hopi land. He would be released from the Sherman Institute, return to Oribe, and reassume his position as chief in 1910. But the harmonious independence, historic self-government, and tribal unity so valued by Tawakwaktiwa and the Hopis, and so revered by Natalie, had been weakened by the interfering and insensitive hands of white men. 5. Time and the World. Put aside for a while all that mesh of complex activities that is entangling your health. Find some placid traveling companion and come west. I shall meet you at the railroad with ponies and a pack horse. Gregory Marwood, also known as George de Cliver Curtis. When Natalie and George returned to California in 1908, they found Frank Meade enjoying life in San Diego and working in partnership with the architect Irving J. Gill. Southern California's Mediterranean climate, an outdoorsy, close-to-the-earth culture, fit Mead's nonconformist lifestyle, and his eclectic Moorish designs resonated with the residents of San Diego. Among Mead and Gill's first important clients was Wheeler J. Bailey, for whom they designed and built Hilero, a home destined to become a landmark on the rocky bluffs north of San Diego, along a wild stretch of beach called La Jolla. Bailey was the same man with whom George had struck up a conversation on his first morning in Riverside. Bailey and the Mendenhalls, whose ranch George may have worked on, and their associates and friends, would become the foundation of George's social circle as he relocated his life to Southern California. Within this circle of wealthy and creative Californians was an energetic, educated, and artistic woman named Alice Ellen Clauber, whose friendship quickly became an important anchor in Natalie's life. Alice was a native Californian, born in 1871 to a prominent merchant's family in San Diego. Like Natalie, Alice was petite and small-boned, and made up for her size with a quick wit, a generous nature, and a bold, inquisitive intellect. Serene, self-assured, and dignified, Alice made friends easily. When she met Natalie, Alice was 37 years old and unmarried. She had plenty of family money and owned her own apartment in downtown San Diego, where, surrounded by her sisters and her friends, she lived a happy and independent life as a single woman. Alice had traveled throughout the United States, twice been to Europe, and in January 1908 had just returned from 7 months abroad, including an extended stay in Italy, where she studied painting with the American master, William Merritt Chase. Alice's father, Abraham Clauber, had immigrated as a young man to California from Czechoslovakia and had built successful wholesale grocery businesses in San Francisco and San Diego. The 9 Clauber children were raised in a home that valued and encouraged art, music, literature, and the finer things of American culture. Since childhood, Alice had loved to draw and paint in much the same obsessive manner that Natalie had loved to play the piano. Although her early years were spent in the frontier town of San Diego, Alice attended high school and came of age in the Paris of the West, San Francisco, in the progressive and active Jewish community of Oakland. Her formal training as a painter began in 1884 at the first art school on the West Coast, the Art Students League, the San Francisco Art Association, where Alice attended classes and socialized with the West's emerging artists and writers. Although a serious student and a talented painter, a career as a painter was hardly among Alice's or any woman's options in the late 1800s. The curriculum at the Art League included a program for aspiring art teachers, but Alice had neither the inclination nor the need to become a school teacher. She just wanted to paint. Her parents indulged her art classes, but expected Alice to marry and raise a family. Exactly how she would combine the socially sanctioned role as wife and mother with the unsanctioned, indeed unheard-of, life of a woman painter, Alice did not know. After completing high school in the 1890s, Alice returned to San Diego. The little town on the Pacific had boomed while the Claubers were in San Francisco, with the completion of the Santa Fe Railway tracks into downtown, and the community's connection to the rest of the United States via the comfort of the train. San Diego's population surged from 2,600 in 1880 to nearly 40,000 in 1887. Alice came close to marriage after meeting the intense young artist Arthur Putnam in the summer of 1894. Putnam was a sculptor who, like Alice, had studied at the Art Students League in San Francisco. When Alice met Putnam, he was living with his mother on a lemon ranch near San Diego and working as a land surveyor with his brother George. Putnam looked like a cowboy artist and was charming and straightforward. According to a biographer and friend, he was extremely handsome, lean as a wolf, with strong, clear-cut features and large, brilliant dark eyes. The intensity of Alice and Putnam's romantic relationship was not recorded by Alice, but they did spend one summer together, sharing their favorite pastime, exploring and drawing the flora and fauna found in the canyons and hills near San Diego. They fell in love, but they would not and could not marry. Alice had money, and Putnam did not. In the successful, self-made merchant family of the Claubers, a gifted but financially insecure artist like Arthur Putnam was not considered an acceptable suitor for their daughter. The relationship ended when Putnam departed San Diego for Chicago and an apprenticeship with the famed animal sculptor Edward Kemmes. Although Alice and Putnam exchanged many letters, and in later years, Alice corresponded with Putnam's wife, Grace Story, Alice never saw Putnam again. At the turn of the century, the Clauber family bought nearly 1,000 acres of rolling hills and canyons in the country outside San Diego. Alice called the family retreat Encanto, enchantment, and it became her haven, where she spent languid days alone, painting, reading, and walking and sketching the countryside. At the age of 30, Alice was drawn to the solitary life of a painter, but as the spinster daughter of one of San Diego's wealthiest and most influential families, she was duty-bound to participate in the social and civic life of the community. In contrast to cities on the eastern seaboard of the United States, in San Diego, a single woman was an accepted member of Southern California's society of independent, educated, progressive, and forward-looking folks involved in building a 20th-century cultural hub on the shores of the Pacific. Two of Alice's sisters, Ella and Lita, were artists and shared Alice's need for creative space and time. Another sister, Stella, was a photographer. Ella eventually married, as did a fifth sister, Laura. Alice did her civic duty and participated in the opening of the city's first art gallery by the Wednesday Club, a women's group, in 1905. But community art events and informal painting classes by visiting artists did not and could not nurture Alice's muse, and her development as an artist was in isolation. San Diego was a cultural backwater on the California frontier, and Alice had almost no peers beyond her sisters and the small handful of women and men painters who visited Southern California. She did have, however, what an unmarried woman needed to undertake serious creative work: money, her own shelter and studio space, and time to herself. Alice also lived in the West, where even single women enjoyed more freedom of movement, physically and socially, than women in the conservative industrial centers of the East Coast. By the turn of the century, women in the American West had access to better educational opportunities and enjoyed positions of leadership in their communities. And women in Western states won the right to vote decades before their counterparts back East: Wyoming in 1869, Utah in 1870, and Colorado in 1893. California would give Alice and her sisters the vote in 1911. Alice had been born and raised in a region that in the first decade of the 20th century was becoming very attractive to women like Natalie Curtis, who sought to emancipate themselves from conventional notions of femininity, whereas the East Coast of America was tame, familiar, domesticated, and ordered. The West Coast was the opposite. Alice offered Natalie an introduction to the refreshingly nonconformist society found in Southern California. And Natalie's arrival in San Diego gave Alice an educated and sophisticated friend who understood and encouraged her need to experience the world of art and culture beyond Southern California. With several of her siblings, Alice toured Europe in 1906, but it was just that, a tour. Alice wanted to study the work of the Grand Masters with contemporary masters. She wanted to experience Europe not as a woman of leisure, but as an artist. The next year, as a mature woman of 36, she was accepted as a student in the European Summer School of William Merritt Chase. On June 8, 1907, Alice boarded the SS Romantic at the Charleston docks in Boston, bound for Punta Delgado and Naples. She traveled with a female cousin, O. Epstein, whom Alice rarely mentioned in the accounts she wrote almost daily in a small red notebook. William Merritt Chase was sophisticated, cosmopolitan, and flamboyant, and with his friend and rival Robert Henry, was considered to be among the most important teachers of American artists in the first decade of the 20th century. Chase's students included Charles DeMuth, Marsden Hartley, Georgia O'Keeffe, John Marin, Rockwell Kent, and Edward Charles Volkert. In 1896, Chase had begun the Chase School of Art, which became the New York School of Art, later Parsons School of Design, with Chase and Henry the principal instructors. Chase was a portrait painter of the first rank and was among the first American artists to paint impressionist landscapes. He knew everyone who counted in American art, and by the summer of Alice's class in Italy, he was the reigning force among the loose constellation of painters called American Impressionists. Chase's students were taught his eclectic painting style, which employed rapid brush strokes and a strong color palette and mirrored the energy and expansion found in New York City at the turn of the century. Among Chase's students in New York in 1907 was the young Georgia O'Keeffe, who, like all of Chase's students, was in awe of him. When he entered the building, a rustle seemed to flow from the ground floor to the top that Chase has arrived. Alice was in Italy with a modern master, and also with a teacher who distinguished himself among his female students by his pronounced lack of male chauvinism. Chase encouraged women of talent to become professional artists, and almost a decade earlier had chaired the committee that made Cecilia Beaux the first woman to receive the prestigious gold medal in art from the Carnegie Institute. After 12 days at sea, on an ocean that was smooth as glass, Alice and her classmates disembarked in Naples, where they were greeted by Chase's assistant, a young painter named Walter Pock. Pock, just 24 years old that summer, was already on the faculty at the Teachers College at Columbia University. Pock was a gifted artist. He had met Chase while studying at the New York School of Art, and after 6 summer tours as Chase's assistant, he was well on his way to becoming a specialist in the new world of modern art emerging in Europe. During the first few weeks of class, Alice was intimidated by Chase and his harsh criticisms of student work. But she persevered, and by late July was among the select group that went with Chase and Pock on private museum tours or out to dinner. There was an immediate connection between the young New Yorker, Walter Pock, and the 30-something Californian, Alice Clauber. They gravitated to one another on class field trips in the Italian countryside and met at sidewalk cafes for long talks about art and travel, painting and painters, and life in the modern world of the 20th century. Everything about that summer in Italy, the instruction, the setting, the social life, her friendship with Pock, was life-changing for Alice. With Chase at the helm, Alice and her classmates went on study and painting trips to Assisi, Bellagio, Padua, Perugia, Pisa, Milan, Venice, and Verona. She also ventured out into the countryside on her own, particularly to rendezvous with 2 California friends, Leo and Gertrude Stein, who were spending the summer at a small villa near Florence. Leo and Gertrude, and their older brother Michael, were childhood friends of Alice's in Oakland. Michael and his wife Sally, and their son, had followed Leo and Gertrude to Paris, where by 1907, Leo and Gertrude's apartment at 27 Rue des Fleuris, with its collection of canvases by unknown painters named Picasso, Matisse, and Cézanne, was the recognized epicenter of the Parisian avant-garde. Gertrude and Leo Stein spent the summer of 1907 at the Casa Ricci in Fiesole. On several afternoons in July, Alice left the noise and heat of Florence and joined the Steins at their villa high above the Arno Valley. Their back patio was a verdant oasis of potted plants and lush flowers, reminiscent of Alice's home on the shores of the Pacific Ocean. Like Alice, Gertrude and Leo loved to walk, and they often hiked together across the Tuscan countryside through poppy fields and groves of fragrant olive trees. One afternoon, the Steins walked with Alice to the home of the Renaissance scholar Bernard Berenson at Settignano. Alice enjoyed the house very much indeed, but especially his books in 3 rooms and all over the hall. We can imagine that on one of these excursions to the Steins' villa above Florence, Alice took along her new friend, Walter Pock, and introduced him to her childhood friends. Alice does not record such an event in her diary, but by late summer of 1907, Pock and the Steins were acquainted, and Pock had an invitation to visit their apartment and salon in Paris. Alice could not have known the importance of the introduction at the time, since Pock was just stepping into the swirling current of modern art, a movement for which he would soon be recognized as a major voice and authority. Gertrude Stein would become famous for her word portraits of friends. Of Walter Pock, she wrote, "Some things are to him beautiful things. Some things are to him desirable things. Learning anything is to him a natural thing. Succeeding in living is to him a natural thing. Teaching anyone is to him a necessary thing. Teaching everything is to him unnecessary thing. With Chase, Pac, and their class, Alice visited the studio and summer home of Henri Matisse near Florence. Pac told Alice he was ambivalent about Matisse's paintings, but throughout the summer he and Alice dined frequently with Matisse and his wife, and by late summer they were friends. Alice enjoyed Matisse as a person and a painter, and after she left Italy, she regularly corresponded with the painter. In the summer of 1907, Pac was beginning what would become a stellar career as an art critic and historian, and was submitting articles and art reviews to American magazines. In August, Alice was with Pac in a bookstore in Rome when he found a copy of the latest Scribner's, which included one of his articles. Alice and the store owner watched a euphoric Pac skip around the shop with the magazine. The article would be the first of scores of published essays and reviews by Pac that would introduce European modern art to America. In Italy, Alice was among artists who were the vanguard of the modern movement. When Chase's summer school came to a close on September 1st, Alice, now fully emancipated as an artist and as a woman, did not take the boat home to America, but remained on the continent. Her diary entries never acknowledged her feelings for Pac, but she confessed that the dissolution of the class and the end of the summer caused her great emotional and physical suffering. With her cousin, O, Alice remained in Europe for another 3 months. Walter Pac remained on the continent as well, and in October, after Alice toured Germany, Belgium, and the Netherlands, she rendezvoused with him in Paris. Gertrude and Leo Stein were back in residence at 27 Rue des Fleuris, and throughout her 4 weeks in Paris, Alice, like Pac, was frequently a guest at their salon. The Steins took Alice to museums and galleries, and may have been alongside her in the Place de la Concorde crowd that watched the flying machine in the sky over Paris on October 26th. Alice and her cousin sailed to America from England on November 18th, after a short visit with Chase at his studio at 303 Fifth Avenue in New York. Alice boarded the train for California and was home by Christmas. Alice had been away from San Diego and her family for 7 months. If she pined for the stimulation and freedom found in Europe, or for the companionship of Pac, she kept it to herself. Pac wrote to Alice even before she climbed on the boat for America. His first letter spoke of his frustration that he had not seen more of her before she departed for England. Pac, fluent in 4 languages, signed the letter, Soyo atto iafmo. Yours sincerely and affectionately, Walter Pac. Throughout the winter and spring, Pac's letters to Alice chronicled his life in Paris among the painters and writers who were breaking bold new ground in art and literature. He told her he was still struggling to like the work of their friend Matisse, and that he had discussed his style with Claude Monet, who was also not a fan of Matisse's canvases. The Steins were almost always mentioned in Pac's letters. The Steins send you their love. He wrote Alice from the Pensione Innocenti, Florence, in August 1908, which I need not tell you is no small thing, even though they do extend its warmth to many people. A year after they parted in France, Pac wrote Alice, It is just a year since I missed you on my return from Amiens. Gee, I wish there were another opportunity to see you. I wouldn't let any chances get mixed with it. In San Diego, Alice was disconnected physically and intellectually from the stimulating society of artists and intellectuals she had moved among in Europe. Unwilling or unable to relocate to Paris, Alice did what she could to bring the energy of the modern art world to Southern California, and made plans to open a gallery to exhibit and sell the work of contemporary American and European artists. Pac offered his assistance, although he could not come and join her in California. Needing money, he had moved back to New York in the fall of 1908, and gone to work full-time as a commercial photographer with his father. Pac was intensely unhappy with his job, and wrote Alice that he found little to like in New York City. The content, tenor, and extent of Alice's letters to Pac can only be guessed at, although throughout his life he collected and carefully archived all of his correspondence. Nothing from Alice was found in his voluminous collection of letters. It is believed that Pac destroyed her letters when he married in February 1914. Women who pursued any creative work in the first decades of the 20th century had to be independent, ambitious, stubborn, unconventional, and tenacious. They also had to endure the loneliness and isolation experienced by all new women of the modern age. Having a friend to share the paradoxes of the disorderly and undomesticated new world was rare, and the arrival in San Diego of the worldly, accomplished, and kindred spirit, Natalie Curtis, must have seemed a godsend to Alice Klauber in the lonely winter of 1908. George Curtis made California his home country when he bought land in the foothills of the Laguna Mountains near Ramona, 20 miles southeast of Escondido. Over several years, George constructed a house, a horse barn, and chicken coop, planted a pecan grove and a kitchen garden, plowed and planted fields of alfalfa, and became a beekeeper. Natalie stayed with George in his rural retreat as often as she stayed in San Diego with Alice and her friends. Natalie might have been considering permanent residence in Southern California, but in 1909 her father became gravely ill, and she hurried cross-country to Washington Place. Bogey's illness was terminal, and he would be bedridden with paralysis the last years of his life. Natalie put aside her work and her dreams of a life in the West, and for nearly 4 years, except to fulfill the most pressing engagements near at hand, never left Bogey's side. Natalie did manage at least one visit to George and her friends. She saw Lummis, among others, in Los Angeles, and the wide-open spaces of the West in May 1910. But even as she moved into the life of an emancipated woman, she understood that in a time of family crisis, her place as an unmarried daughter was beside her mother and her father. During the years of her father's illness, Natalie was forced to make peace with her divided self, which loved and needed her nuclear family, but yearned for the freedoms found among people and places far away from their Greenwich Village world. "I hunger and thirst so for a bed on the ground that once freed, I don't believe I can ever go into New York chains again," she wrote Alice Herdlichka. What a problem to have a primeval soul and one's home in New York. While she was living in New York City, Natalie's sponsors, Charlotte Mason, George Peabody, and Hollis Frizzell, the principal of the Hampton School in Virginia, urged her to do for Negro music what she had done for Indian music. Natalie had recorded Negro folk songs and spirituals as early as 1904, but in 1910 she began a comprehensive study of African-American music with the staff and students of the Hampton School. Important to Natalie's survival during the years of Bogey's illness were her friendships with musicians living in New York, who shared her advocacy of musical education for America's poor. Kurt Schindler, a 28-year-old Berlin-born musician and a staff conductor of the Metropolitan Opera House, had become a friend when he worked at G. Schirmer, and she sought his advice while writing The Indians Book. In 1909, Schindler founded New York's McDowell Chorus, renamed the Schola Cantorum in 1912. After Natalie returned to New York, she and Schindler joined forces to promote music education for New York City's immigrant and minority children. Mimsy Curtis was already involved with the kindergarten reform movement that developed in tandem with the Settlement House movement famously established at Jane Addams's Hull House on Chicago's West Side in 1889. Gertrude House, a settlement house associated with the Chicago Kindergarten Institute, had incorporated music in their curriculum in the early 1890s. Natalie wanted to bring music to children at the settlement houses in New York and took her idea to Mimsy and the board, on which Mimsy served as vice president, of the Mary Walton Free Kindergarten for Colored Children on West 63rd Street. With the backing of Mimsy's organization, Natalie assembled her own board of influential individuals, which included Schindler, the violinist David Manis, the brother musicians Frank and Walter Damrosch, the patron of the arts George Foster Peabody, and the attorney and family friend Elbridge Adams, and founded the Music School Settlement for Colored People, which opened in New York City in November 1911. The men and women involved with early 20th century philanthropic and reform organizations were people of enormous verve, compassion, and talent. Natalie's work at the music settlement houses introduced her to several individuals with whom she would form lasting and important friendships. Among these was Charles Winfred Douglas, an Episcopalian priest and a professionally trained musician and linguist who may have served on Natalie's music school's board of directors. Douglas, a canon in the Diocese of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, was a talented musicologist who had studied Gregorian chants in Europe among the Benedictine monks, and was among the first Americans to translate the ancient musical form called plain chant or plain song. But Douglas's most remarkable characteristic, at least to Natalie, was his interest in and knowledge of the American Southwest. In 1911, Douglas was the music director of the Community of St. Mary, a boarding school for girls in Peekskill, a town on the Hudson River just north of New York City. Douglas kept an apartment in Manhattan and frequently came into the city to see his colleagues Frank and Walter Damrosch and his good friend Kurt Schindler. Born in Oswego, New York, in 1867, Douglas was tall and big-boned, imposing, confident, brusque, and good-humored, with an orator's voice and a preacher's shepherding bossiness. Like Natalie, Douglas was an overachieving doer and seeker. When he was in full health, Douglas was a man of tremendous energy. But also like Natalie, Douglas's passion for his work and his relentless creative drive frequently pushed him to exhaustion. Much like Natalie's inaugural trip to Arizona, Douglas's first journey to the American West was precipitated by a physical collapse brought on by an obsessive work schedule. In 1893, after simultaneously obtaining degrees from Syracuse University in music and St. Andrew's Divinity School, where he was ordained, Douglas came to New York City to work as music curate at the Church of the Redeemer and to teach music at St. John's Parochial School. In his first winter in New York, 27-year-old Douglas, overworked, exhausted, and ill, collapsed while practicing the organ one night after choir rehearsal. He was taken to Presbyterian Hospital, where he lay near death with the complications of double pneumonia for 9 weeks. After several months of convalescing in New York, Douglas was sent out west, where it was hoped his lungs would heal in the high, dry air. Douglas boarded a train for Denver, where he met and married Mary Josepha Williams, a graduate of Gross Medical School and the joint director of a small sanatorium on Pearl Street in Denver. Dr. Joe, as she was called, was the daughter of a wealthy Detroit family with major land holdings in Colorado and Denver's first woman doctor. She owned several hundred acres of land near the Evergreen stage stop, and with Douglas built a spectacular summer home on the property they named Camp Neosho. In the early 1900s, Douglas began lecturing at Northwestern's School of Music and helped to develop the music programs at Gertrude House in Chicago. Freed of financial concerns by his wife's wealth, Douglas traveled between an apartment in New York City and his home in Evergreen, where his only son, Frederick, Eric Huntington Douglas, was born in 1897. Douglas sailed for England in May 1901 and spent the next year in England, Scotland, Germany, and France, listening to and studying Gregorian chants and ancient plain chant. When he returned to the United States, Douglas was determined to bring the heavenly chanting music of plain song into mainstream American liturgical music. In the fall of 1902, Douglas and his wife and son moved into an apartment in New York City on West 84th Street. Douglas resumed his duties as curate at the Church of the Redeemer and joined Damrosch's Musical Arts Society. By the winter of 1903, the canon's health broke again. After months at various convalescent centers and retreats in New York, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts, Douglas headed out west. For 6 months, Douglas lived in a tent and slept in a bedroll in the wilderness of the Rio Grande of New Mexico, on the high desert of the Kaibab Plateau, and in the deep canyons of the Colorado River in Arizona. He lived alone and with the Indians he met on his journey, including the Hopis, who adopted Douglas and named him Tall Pine Tree. Douglas submersed himself in the culture and art of the native tribes and began to collect Pueblo pottery and baskets and Navajo rugs and blankets. 6 months on the high desert healed Douglas, and in 1904 he donned his city clothes and pastoral collar and returned to work. Now a vocal advocate of Indian art and culture and a student of Indian music, Douglas lectured to audiences in Chicago and New York about Native America. When exactly Douglas became cognizant of the work of Natalie Curtis is not known, but by 1907 and the publication of the Indians book, he had surely met her. Schindler likely introduced them. Douglas was a board member of Schindler's Schola Cantorum from its inception, and Schindler had been friends with Natalie since editing her Indians book. By the fall of 1912, Douglas's appointment book noted frequent meetings with Natalie. Bogey died just after the Thanksgiving holiday in late November 1912. George came from California and joined his mother and siblings to bury Edward Curtis in the family cemetery in Providence, Rhode Island. Augusta was 72 years of age. Natalie was 37. Augusta may have hoped her spinster daughter would settle permanently in the house on Washington Place. But she knew, too, that Natalie had unfinished business, an unfinished life, on the other side of the continent. And now that George was healthy and happy in his own home in California, even Bridget agreed that only the American West could restore Natalie's health and her spirit. Natalie and George thought it was time their mother saw for herself the country that had claimed the hearts of two of her children, and in April 1913, Natalie boarded the train west with Mimsy. For Augusta Curtis, it was a journey into an exotic foreign land. The west coast of the United States and the desert and mountains that served as a line of demarcation between civilized and frontier America was still very much another country. Mimsy had heard in detail about Natalie's adventures in the Southwest, and she may have read all or parts of George's novel, The Wooing of a Recluse, which would be published the next winter by the Devon Adair Company. The novel was a grand romantic monologue by an unnamed cowboy, written in letters to his lover, Pandora, back in New York. The narrator's transition from a life in upper-class New York City to a cattle ranch in Arizona very much paralleled the life of George DeCliver Curtis. Although George's cowboy protagonist went east to reunite with his love, George, the cowboy writer, never lived in the East again, but set down deep roots in his land near Ramona. If George Curtis had ever had a gal back in New York or Boston, she lost him to his new love, Southern California. George wrote under a pseudonym, Gregory Marwood, but his Harvard classmates, friends, and family in New York and Boston understood that the romantic novel of letters from an Arizona cowboy to his society girl back east offered glimpses into the author's own life. And throughout the novel, there were passages that seemed written just for his sister, Natalie. Put aside for a while all that mesh of complex activities that is entangling your health. Find some placid traveling companion and come west. I shall meet you at the railroad with ponies and a pack horse, and you may roam this unseeing land with as little regard for the conventionalities as when you once slid down the roof of our ice house. I will be your guide, cook, and horse wrangler. You need only ride and be glad, for time and the world will be all yours if you so choose, and in the freshness of a natural life, you will forget that you were once in a fair way to be an invalid. Back in California again, Natalie immersed herself in the natural life where she could, in George's words, live with little regard for conventionalities. George met Natalie and Mimsy at the San Diego Railroad Station, possibly with Alice Clauber, who had a car and was a good friend of both George and Natalie. Alice's extended family in San Diego included half a dozen siblings, and the Curtis women had invitations to stay in the homes of several prominent families, including Alice's mother, Teresa Clauber, who had been a widow for less than 2 years. Mimsy stayed a month in California. With Natalie and Alice as her companions, she explored the little city of San Diego and went out for overnight retreats in La Jolla. They also stayed with George at his ranch in the rolling hills, 30 miles inland. In late April, Natalie, George, and Mimsy motored north of San Diego with Alice to Hilero, Wheeler Bailey's weekend retreat on the La Jolla Bluffs above the Pacific Ocean. Bailey, called Uncle Wheeler by Alice and Natalie, invited Alice and the Curtises to spend a few nights at the fabulous house designed by Irving J. Gill and Frank Meade. The auto journey out to Hilero's breathtaking perch above the ocean was through a paradisiacal and pastoral landscape of green fields and wildflowers where sheep and cattle grazed. Hilero was only 5 years old, but it had already achieved significant national attention from builders and designers for its Moorish architectural elements and for its museum-quality collection of Native American arts and crafts. Although Natalie appreciated the collection of Indian art that decorated the walls and windowsills of the house, Hilero's greatest treasure for a musician was the red Steinway piano covered by a Navajo rug on the large first-floor portico. Natalie wrote about their days at Hilero as a sort of California idyll, a song of the Pacific Coast. Their meals were served at long tables on the covered porches and out in the gardens. If they ate in the dining room, the enormous doors were wide open to the sounds of the surf and the seabirds. Natalie, George, and Alice, perhaps Mimsy too, chose to leave the comfort of their beds and private rooms and slept on the large second-floor balcony under the stars. Natalie, George, Mimsy, Bailey's relative Wheeler North, and Alice signed Hilero's guestbook before departing on April 28th. George wrote in French and English about Mélodie Écossaise, sung at Hilero, where even Auld Lang Syne has an original touch. Natalie filled an entire page of the guestbook with the musical notes and the Navajo, with English translation, words of a Navajo peace chant, adding Indian thoughts inspired by a windswept day and a night on the porch of Hilero, the Blanco Hogan of the Pacific Slope. Mimsy departed California for New York in the first week of May. Natalie remained on the West Coast and moved between George's ranch and her rented rooms in downtown San Diego. By 1914, she was living in the Palomar Apartments, a building designed by Frank Meade and partners at the corner of 6th and Maple, within walking distance of Alice's home in downtown San Diego. From her rooms at the Palomar, Natalie could watch the construction of the buildings and gardens of the San Diego Panama, California Exposition that would open in 1915. Begun in 1912, the 1,400-acre exposition grounds of Balboa Park would define modern San Diego. Although the exposition was to celebrate the opening of the Panama Canal, the museums and exhibits of Balboa Park would catapult San Diego into the 20th century and bring Southern California's art, history, and natural resources national attention. Southern California was fiercely hot and dry in June and July 1913. Natalie frequently stayed for weeks at a time on the unseeing land of George's ranch. He was digging a well, installing a pump, and trenching a pipeline that would bring water to the house. Natalie was strong again and worked alongside George doing ranch chores until noon. After lunch, they napped through the heat of the afternoon, and in the evenings, they read aloud to one another from the newspapers and magazines Mimsy sent from New York. "Cleared poison oak under Merlin's oak," George wrote in his lined pocket diary on July 18th, "and read a little Dante, and snoozed there in the afternoon. Natalie and I walked up to the spring when the sun went and brought back a pail of water." With Alice, Natalie motored up and down the coast and out to La Jolla for overnights with Alice's friends. She also went north to Pasadena for several days and visited Lummis. They listened to Lummis's recordings of Indian songs and discussed Washington's latest political appointments and their Indian policies. Life in California was not all play. Natalie worked on several pieces for publication, including two articles about Indian music for The Outlook. But her benefactors, like George Foster Peabody, although pleased to know she was in good health, believed she ought to return to the East and get back to the real work that awaited her attention. Her comprehensive piece about African-American musicians, the Negro's contribution to the music of America, had come out in The Outlook in March, and Natalie needed to complete the project at the Hampton School. If Natalie heard Peabody's call for her return to New York, she did not heed it. Instead, in the summer of 1913, she pushed deeper into Indian country and the wild frontier. 6. Secrets and Dualities. Women are not supposed to take up much room, or to go very far from home, or to stay away for long. They are not supposed to be by themselves. They are supposed to hear and obey, to come back when they are called. Virginia Scharf. While Natalie was keeping vigil beside her dying father in his room near Washington Square, a similar family drama was transpiring in the J. Bishop Johnson House on the tiny Massachusetts island of Nahant. On a clear day, the gold dome of the Massachusetts State House was visible from the front porch of the Johnson home on Dorothy Cove. Even so, urban Boston and the professional music world in which J. Bishop's granddaughter Carol had lived and worked for more than a decade belonged to a universe that existed far beyond the shores of the fishing community on the small island. In 1912, when Caroline Bishop Stanley was summoned home, she was employed as a piano teacher at the prestigious Hannah More Girls Academy in Maryland. As the only child and single daughter of a widowed, ailing mother, Carol was bound by duty and principle to leave her position as a music instructor and return to Nahant. Carol's mother, Fanny, lived in the Bishop family house on Dorothy Cove with Carol's grandmother and Nahant's oldest resident, 84-year-old Elmira Choate Johnson. Coming home to care for her mother on Nahant meant Carol had to resign from one of the few professional positions available to a woman with a bachelor's degree in music in 1912. It also meant Carol, at 32, was completely dependent on her family. Carol Stanley had lived and breathed music since she was a young child. Unlike her future friend, Natalie Curtis, Carol's education and departure from the bosom of the family on the island of Nahant was a hard-won accomplishment, nearly every step taken in defiance of the communal and familial tide of expectation. Carol's father, Edwin Stanley, had died on Nahant in the 1880s when Carol was a small child, and Carol and her mother had gone to live with her grandparents in their house on the beach. Grandmother Elmira was widowed in 1896. So by the turn of the century, the J. Bishop Johnson House had become the domain of two widows and a serious-minded young girl who wanted only one thing in life, to play the piano. The history of Nahant Island was the story of the extended Johnson family. There were two distinct and separate Johnson lineages, and Carol's mother's family was related to the latecomers, the Maine-based Johnsons, who had come to the island in the mid-1800s. The first Johnsons predated Carol's family by two centuries and were listed among the first three families to settle the island in the 1600s. In spite of their lack of residential longevity, Carol's family was considered island royalty, especially since her grandfather's first wife, Caroline, was a Johnson of the first pedigree. Carol's maternal grandfather, known around the island as J. Bishop, came to Nahant from Maine with several of his brothers. By the mid-1800s, the Johnson brothers had a thriving fish business, and J. Bishop built a family home at the corner of Willow and Valley Roads, beside the Johnson Fish Market, a short walk from the waters of Massachusetts Bay. Carol was born on December 16, 1879. By that time, there were Johnsons belonging to one of the two Johnson families in every classroom, business, and neighborhood in the village of Nahant and out along the island shoreline. The dual lineage of the Johnson name befits the island, as Nahant is a place of dualities and twins, of mirrors and magnification, and the island's history is laced with stories of the seen and unseen, above and below land and water. The name Nahant was derived from the Indian word Nahanto, twins, and the island is actually two islands, Little and Big Nahant, that are connected by tombolos, isthmuses, that flood at high tide. Before the raised cart road was built in the mid-1800s, islanders could only reach the mainland and the neighboring town of Lynn on horseback or in buggies when the tide was out. This limited and rhythmic accessibility created a community where business revolved around the tide tables. In the earliest accounts of fishermen and sailors, there was frequent mention of a peculiar optical illusion called doubling, seen on the sea near Nahant Island. When certain weather and cloud conditions existed, ships and landmarks appeared to be mirrored in the cloud ceiling. This doubling was so endemic to Nahant that early historians included illustrations of the phenomenon, and poets wrote of the mirrored and magical world above and below Nahant. Nahant was a place of doubles and also of secrets. Along the coastline, where the land has been battered and shaped by the waves of the Atlantic, there are numerous caves and secret passages. Spouting Horn was so named because of the sound the sea makes as it crashes through this formation on the rocky cliff on the island's eastern tip. Swallow's Cave is a deep channel 72 feet long and 8 feet high that opens into the sea and is accessible only by climbing down rock cliffs to the cave's entrance at low tide. Nearer the center of the island, on the high land near the village proper, is the Witch's Cave, where several women eluded capture and prosecution during the Salem witch trials in 1692. Caroline Bishop Stanley was, in body and in spirit, a Nahanter. She had a twin brother, Edward, who lived only 2 months. Caroline had an older brother who died during childbirth, so after her twin died, Caroline was raised as an only child. In true mirroring style, Carol was named for her grandfather, J. Bishop Johnson's first wife, Caroline Johnson, who had died in childbirth 30 years before. Although the public death record confirms that Carol's twin died in February 1880, there was never again an acknowledgement in private or public accounts that Carol's mother had given birth to twins. We assume that Carol was told about her twin brother, but the keeping of such a secret would not have been out of character among the Johnsons or any other family with deep roots on the island of Nahant. Carol's childhood on Nahant in the 1880s and 90s coincided with the island's heyday as the resort and second home community of Boston's elite, as the northeast seaboard was transformed by American industry and Boston became crowded and dirty. City folk looked east across the water to rural Nahant, a pastoral island of peace and quiet, untouched by industrial America. The island off the shore of the bustling town of Lynn was a quiet backwater during the New England winter. But each summer, Nahant's population more than doubled with day trippers from Boston who came in droves on the daily ferries and seasonal residents who moved into their grand cottages for the summer. In 1821, Colonel Thomas H. Perkins and William Payne bought East Point, the Ram Pasture, and built a fine hotel. By 1903, the island boasted 14 hotels, several of which were grand affairs that catered to the ultra-wealthy. On Nahant, the Brahmins could escape the heat and pollution of the city, and often a stay on the island prompted visitors to build second home cottages along the beaches and up in the village. Although Boston's Brahmins brought to the island the culture and money of Boston high society, they shed the posturing and formalities inherent to urban life. The family breadwinner could continue to commute to his work on Beacon Hill or near the State House and Commons, while his wife and children could soak up the healthy sea air and sun while swimming and boating or riding horseback at the stables. The island's part-time residents included Boston's most prominent families, Samuel A. Eliot, father of Charles W. Eliot, the future president of Harvard, kept a residence on the island, and the family of George H. Mifflin, of the publishing house, spent summers in their home on Nahant. Natalie's Uncle George's close friend, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, the iconic American poet, was perhaps Nahant's most famous resident. Longfellow lived in Cambridge and taught at Harvard, but beginning in 1850, he came each summer with his family and lived in their home directly across the cove from Carol's grandfather's fish market. Another friend of George Curtis's, the statesman Henry Cabot Lodge, was a child on Nahant. Lodge's father, John E. Lodge, had come to the island in the 1830s, and after he married Anna Cabot in 1842 and moved to Beacon Hill to raise their two children, he returned to build a grand summer house on Nahant. As a U.S. senator, Henry Cabot Lodge retreated to Nahant for solitude and respite from politics. Although busy with the matters of Washington and the world, he served as Nahant town moderator for 20 years and remained a trustee for the Nahant Public Library for over four decades. Lodge was not a progressive Republican like Theodore Roosevelt, but aligned himself with the conservatives who dominated the Senate when Roosevelt was president. Although often at political odds, Lodge was a welcomed friend at Roosevelt's home, Sagamore Hill, and Roosevelt came to Nahant to visit Lodge at his family retreat. Around Nahant, Carolyn Stanley was the local girl who excelled on the piano. In 1894, when Carol, called Carrie as a child, was 15, she played Smiling Springtime at the Nahant graduation exercises. There were only three graduates that year. All of the children on Nahant attended one school. But the whole town turned out for the event, which included orchestral performances, several violin and piano solos, including Carol's, six student recitations, and an address titled The Nation's Progress by graduating senior Charles Cabot Johnson. Carol Stanley graduated Nahant School in a similar ceremony in 1899 and entered Mount Holyoke College the next fall. But the Massachusetts Women's College didn't offer the level of music instruction Carrie wanted, and in the autumn of 1900, she transferred to the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston. The New England Conservatory of Music was undergoing dramatic growth in the first years of the 20th century. In Carol's third year, the conservatory moved out of cramped quarters in the south end of Boston and into a new building near the Boston Symphony Orchestra's headquarters. The school began an affiliation with Harvard, and in June 1903, when the conservatory's new Jordan Hall and its modern, elegant, and acoustically perfect stage and auditorium opened, the New England Conservatory boasted, and rightly so, that it could compete with any music school in the world. Indeed, by 1906, even the